Gooch, you're somebody that I've been wanting to interview for a long time. I'm really excited to have you on. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me. I've been waiting for your call, man. I mean, I feel like ever since we retired, you're so big time. I'm like, when is Herb gonna call me? I know he's gonna call me sometime. Today's the day. Let's do it.
You don't need a front. I've been trying to get you on and do something with you for like over a year. You know this is true. You've got such an unreal story. You've played in, I believe, 8 different countries, some of the best leagues in the world. You're a first in a lot of things. So before I go to the residency, well, that's where I'll start it. Walk me through, I guess, your upbringing. Were you always this massive, this big, this strong?
Absolutely not. I was always tall, obviously, which is kind of weird because my mom's like 5'5", my father's like 5'8", and then you have this lanky kid. I was always a little long and skinny, and then I guess middle school, high school, I wanted to kind of beef up because my older brother was very massive, and he was extremely strong, and I wanted to be like my older brother, you know, and hit the weight rooms and, you know, kind of went through puberty a little bit, and there we go. Genetics hit in.
You're the 1982 age group, which is the same age group as I am. That's the first residency program. Most don't understand what this is because nowadays you have academies. Nowadays you see, well, there used to be the DA, so kids are playing a lot more. But back then, it was the first, I guess, age group where they got 40 kids together and they lived in Bradenton, Florida.
Right.
And the goal was for them to train together for 2 years to compete in what was the U-17 World Cup. Talk about some of the players that were on that team and what it was like.
Man, that program was hell while we were going through it as little kids. I look back now, it was the best thing that could have happened to me. But essentially, yeah, we were at the time U16, U17 players, and we were literally being taken out of our school environment wherever we were, California, Maryland, DC, New York, Indiana, Texas, like once a month for like 10 days to two weeks. And it was hard for us, you know, to miss that kind of school and then come back and try and catch up and then do it all over again the following month for the next camp. And essentially U.S. Soccer decided, you know, instead of doing this, why don't we just bring all these players together in one location, school them there, train them there, and put them in a real football environment, which is what we did with the residency program. We were the first guinea pigs of that. And, you know, everybody knows that initial residency, our team, we still hold the record right there. We lost in PKs in the semifinals of the World Championships. But we had a very, very special team. You know, DeMarcus Beasley won the Silver Ball. Landon Donovan won the Golden Ball. We had Kyle Beckerman there. We had Bobby Convey there. We had Alex Yee there. We had, you know, Abe Thompson, Jordan Sela, DJ Countess, Nelson Aquari, Seth Tremblay. We had a multitude of young stars on that team. And I think what set us apart from probably other teams or other national teams that followed us was our mentality. Like we were little. We had chips on our shoulders. We were out to prove every match, regardless of who we played against. I'm sure DeMarcus or anybody else could tell you stories of when we would scrimmage against MLS teams and they would hate us because we would trash talk them from the beginning to the end of the game, because we had something to prove. We wanted to be in their shoes and we wanted to prove that we were capable.
Gucci, you're touching upon that mentality that you guys had. You guys had players like yourself, DeMarcus Beasley, Landon Donovan, obviously mentally strong, with this bravado that you have at this youth, age now. Do you see that in today's pool of players with the national team?
Do I see that? I mean, obviously every generation has its differences, right? I would say that ours was unique. You know, we were together from U17, U20, U23s to the first team. And I don't think I've seen, thus far, and I could be wrong, but a youth national team at the 17 level that had so many graduating, players go to every level afterwards and have such a long, withstanding career. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Kyle's the only one currently still playing, because he's still, drinking from the fountain of youth. Somebody really does need to check his water bottle at this point right now. But, you know, we had such a large number of players from that team. And I do give a lot of credit to our coach, John Ellinger, because he was probably the best option to coach us in that state, at that age. And he put this hunger inside of all of us and this belief that, you know, we were capable of anything. I recall one camp, he told us, he said, any team can compete with any other team in the world for at least 15 minutes. He's like, the best teams extend that duration. And I was like, huh. He's like, so think about that. He's like, you can hang with anybody for at least 15 minutes in any game. And we believed it. And we went out every game, MLS, international tournaments, believing that, like, we can compete and we can win.
It's interesting because a few of your teammates opted to go straight into professional ranks, you know, DeMarcus, Landon. You opted to go to Clemson. Was it lack of options or was it that you wanted to go to college?
It was not lack of options. At that point, we were on a high. We finished the world championship so well. A lot of European scouts were all over a multitude of our players on the team. And my parents were like, sorry, nope, you're going to school. And then if you decide after experiencing college that this is not for you, then it's your option. But right now it's our choice. You're going to college. It sounds like, okay, fair enough.
Fair enough. You've experienced a wealth of, I guess, cultural experiences when it comes to football around the world and development. In your opinion, now looking back at it all, does college set the player, American player, back as far as development?
I think every platform has its benefits. And I think it's naive and foolish in the U.S. landscape in a country this big, pretty much a continent, to exclude the college game from the pyramid of development, because it makes no sense, right? So if you think about it, a young player, everybody develops at different paces. As you said, Landon and DeMarcus went straight into the professional ranks. I can now tell you now, at almost 38 years old, had I had done that as a young defender, I probably wouldn't have been ready to withstand the rigors and what the responsibilities were for me, or even understand the game at that point. I think that the college game really groomed me and prepared me in ways that I needed at that time. So I definitely believe that there's different paths for everybody, and for coaches or directors or even higher ups to say that the college game doesn't have a part in its pyramid, it's ignorant, because it definitely does.
What would you change about it? I mean, would you extend the season? Would you make it more of a professional atmosphere for the athlete?
I definitely would look into extending the season of the college game. Obviously, condensing it to 3 or 4 months really handcuffs the coaches and the programs in regards to the development of those players and giving them competitive games and the number of competitive games. I think that based on different conferences, you have different difficulty levels, but to condense the college season, because the college season is very difficult because you're playing like 2-3 games a week. And for anybody, your muscles break down, injuries, everything like that. If you could extend that, you know, for 4 more months and have a more of a time gap in between the games, you would have a better product at the end of the day.
Gucci, from Clemson, you go on to European soccer, you end up at Metz, second division. But that's not where I want to go. I want to go when you finally get to Belgium, Genk-Liège. When you're finally there and you experience that culture for an American kid coming out of college and getting that brush of professionalism, what was it like?
Well, I mean, the European culture coming from America in football is like a slap to the face, right? Because you're here in America, and football is growing right now, but definitely 17, 20 years ago, it wasn't there in the country. It was just beginning. And, you know, you step foot in Europe and France and you're amongst all these players that have been dreaming of this moment since they could walk, you know, whereas maybe I was only dreaming of it since I could drive a car, you know. And when I made that transfer from Metz to Standard Liège, you know, I'm kind of one of those persons that just take things as it comes, and I'm going to give my 100% regardless of the surroundings. And I think that the club and the culture embraced me in that, and they kind of didn't look at me as an American. They saw me as Onyewu, the American, you know, not the American Onyewu. And they really embraced me, hence why I got my citizenship, got my papers, all that stuff. But, I embraced the language, I embraced the culture, and I essentially became one of them.
Did the fact that Landon and DeMarcus playing in the 2002 World Cup influence your decision at all? Like, this is what I want to do. This is tangible now. I just saw my boys playing a World Cup. I'm going to play in a World Cup.
300%. I remember watching them in the World Cup, and I was like, damn it. I was like, what if I was there? You know, would I be ready for that? And, you know, from that tournament on, from that summer on, I was like, I'm going to be in the next World Cup. You know, because if they can do it, why can't I do it? I was playing with them every day. I was living with them every day. I feel that I can get to that level. And, you know, they basically set a mark for me to achieve and to reach, from that summer of 2002 onward.
Looking at that team, it's a very storied team in our culture in American soccer. Could you have played on that team?
Right now, or as a 19-year-old?
You and I can't play pickup anymore, brother.
Hey, come on, man. Hey, man, speak for yourself, brother. Speak for yourself.
That's true. That's true.
So as a 19-year-old?
Yeah.
As a 19-year-old, I don't think I was ready. And
what was missing?
Experience. I mean, the game was different back then, as you know it. You know, I remember when my first call up to the national team, I was 21, 22. As a defender, and that was young back then, you know, and now you have 18, 19, 20 year olds right now, on the first team. And that's just the evolution of the sport in the modern athlete. But back then, you know, they didn't even want to look at you if you were under the age of 25 and wanted to be a starter on a team as a defender. So I definitely lacked the experience. And with experience comes knowledge. And I think as a young player, or as an older player now, I can assess and say, okay, I would have probably drowned had I been there on that stage. But it set a benchmark for me to try and reach.
So you're in Belgium now. You start off with a bang. You're one of the best defenders in the league. Not only best defenders, I think you were voted best foreigner in the league in 2004-05, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
You get this newfound attention. What's that like for a young guy?
It's dangerous. That's what it is. It's dangerous, you know, because as a young adult, as a young person, or the young professional athlete, it's important that you don't fall into that trap of believing what they're feeding you, right? And you have to stay grounded if you want to progress and keep on achieving success. And so my first year at Liège, where I was, you know, best 11 in the league, I was best foreign transfer. I was, you know, the following year I was U.S. Soccer Player of the Year and all that stuff. And, you know, luckily for me, I have a support system within my family that were like, we don't give a damn who you are. You're Gucci. When you come home, we don't see you as a soccer player. So understand that. And we're proud of you, but, you know, your work's not done.
Now, I'm going to phrase this as cutthroat, but did it surprise you how cutthroat the game was around the world, that culture? Because it was one of the first things that surprised me when I went abroad is how it was a job to people, how young individuals, 18, 19, 20, were already the head figures of their household and were pretty much supplying what was wages and what was living expenses for their family. So they would go out and kill themselves on the field. Did it surprise you how cutthroat maybe the culture was?
I mean, it was definitely different, you know, being a 19-year-old coming from the college game, right? Where my concerns were passing a class and getting the class on time, getting to the cafeteria before the good stuff finished, to now a professional environment where a player maybe my age or maybe 2 or 3 years older is now the sole provider for his family, right? And so you come from an atmosphere where everyone's friendly, everyone's together, to a professional atmosphere where the locker room's still good, everyone's still friendly, everyone's still together, but it's a job. right? And your job is to be better than the next person, regardless. And so it was definitely a wake up call, but I think I understood that. You know, I think I was smart enough to be like, okay, you know, he's a cool guy. I love him, but we play the same position. So he's not going to want from me more than what he's getting, right?
And right.
So that's how I took it.
Let's fast forward now to your Philadelphia career. When you get there real quick, did it surprise you to see maybe that the mentality wasn't that it was a very, we're still a very suburban sport in the States, in America, and a lot of these players maybe don't understand what it's like? Seeing that then versus now, could you mark the contrast?
100%. I mean, you can definitely see it. Like I said, the mentality of the younger players coming in, the mentality of some of the older experienced players that were there. And I won't say I was surprised, because throughout my career, obviously I've had a lot of friends that have been playing in the MLS. I talked to them. They kind of gave me their insight of what their feelings were of the league. So I came to the league, playing my last year. So I didn't have great expectations on that side. I knew what to expect.
Right.
I knew how to temper myself. And so things didn't get to me. Had I had perhaps been here from the beginning or 10 years or 5 years, it might be a different story. But at that time, I was definitely aimed at enjoying football. Now, this was the first time I could play in America. This is the first time I could be on a team where I had friends. You know, that was foreign to me for 15 years, 16 years. I've never been on a team where I had a friend on it, you know? And so the locker room dynamics were completely different, and I enjoyed it.
But when you see those players and their upbringing, what would you change maybe for Major League Soccer? Is it just a Major League Soccer sense, or is it a cultural sense of the sport in America, the pressure, the attention?
I don't think I'd put all the pressure on Major League Soccer, right? Because if you think about it, Major League Soccer, it's a young organization in comparison to every other football league in the world. I think it's a culture thing. And you can't put it on anything besides culture. When you're in Europe, when you're in South America, when you're in Africa, your parents want you to be a soccer player. they pray that you're a boy so you can, your first president is a ball.
Yeah.
I hope he's right-footed or left-footed, you know, and he's going to be the next Ronaldo. He's going to be the next Romario. He's going to be the next Desai. He's going to be the next something, some staplehead, some figure in that country. Whereas in America, it's not better. It's not worse. It's just different. You know, we have different expectations for our kids. We hope he's a doctor, which is great. We hope he's a lawyer, which is wonderful. We hope he's the next Michael Jordan, which is fantastic. And in that pyramid, the bottom of the totem pole is probably soccer, right? And so with that, you don't get instilled the kind of hunger that you needed early on until maybe later on in your adolescence. And then you start to understand it.
Let's go right now to the national team. When you started playing with the national team, you had kind of a quick ascension. I remember one of the most iconic moments in U.S. soccer history for me was a 2005 Dos Acero game in Columbus versus Mexico. I believe it was the DeMarcus Beasley set piece, the free kick play where he ends up scoring a goal. You had the stare down with Jared Borghetti. He's a storied Mexican.
We call him Jared Borghetti, but you can say it in your accent if you want.
Jared Borghetti. Yeah, I know Jared very well because I work with him at Deportes, and I've asked him about this. I remember we were in Russia.
Oh,
and I asked,
Lord, what did he say?
I was like, "Hey, you really going to try to step to Gooch?" And he was dead serious. I mean, he joked about it afterwards, but he was like, "What's he going to do? Back down?" That was one of the most iconic moments. Walk me through what you were thinking. Were you thinking like, "Man, I will wreck this guy"?
At that point, we had played previously in Azteca Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And this was my first experience in Azteca. I remember people kind of gassing it up and building it up and like, "Oh, Azteca, you can't breathe." And literally when you play there, the altitude, you can't breathe. You can't, like after your first 10 minutes for a sprint, you want to ask for a sub because you're like, "I can't recover." But, I remember that game. He got a step on me on a cross that went across the box, came back across the box, and he got a head on it right before I could intersect and clear it. And I was pissed off. I was young. I was, 23, 24. I don't know how old I was. And I was pissed off.
You were 22. In 2005, you were 22.
I could have been. I don't know. These days in the quarantine. With quarantine, time is arbitrary right now.
Exactly.
But I remember the feeling, and I felt like I let my team down. Bruce is never going to call me up again. You know, that little kid feeling that, like,
yeah,
I made a mistake. It's all on my shoulders. I'm never going to get a chance again. I'm cut from the national team, this and that. And then I in my head, I said, if I get this opportunity again, I am going to murder this guy. I'm going to murder this team, and they're not going to have an opportunity to do this a second time. Fortunately, not far after that defeat, we were able to play them in Columbus. And, you know, everyone knows the end result and the stare down and the tension in that game and the outcome ultimately.
Have you ever crossed paths with Jared again after that?
I have not. I don't – well, not that I recall. I could have maybe in a game, but if I did, the tensions weren't as high as that game, that's for sure. But like I said, for me to have done that, it's because I respected him so much and I wanted to be respected as well, right? And so he was this household name in Mexico, household name in CONCACAF.
Right.
And he essentially didn't know me because I was young on the scene. And then he was just like, who is this big brick wall just like wanting to fight me? And I was like, I want you to know my name.
Right.
You need to understand who I am just like I understand who you are. And I believe, like you said, you spoke to him. He definitely remembered.
Oh, of course he remembers. A lot of people remember that. It was one of the iconic moments between Mexico and the U.S. men's national team. Now, because of that game, you ultimately qualify. I think because of that game was the qualifying factor for the 2006 World Cup. Walk me through this 2006 World Cup, your first World Cup. You finally make it. This is your dream. I believe you guys were so highly rated that FIFA had some unreal ranking on you guys. Was it number 3 in the world?
I think we were number 2 or 3 before the World Cup.
Give me your thoughts on that, Bruce.
You laugh, but I mean, I'm not going to say we were number 2 or 3, but we were a confident team. We had a lot of ability on that squad. You know, Casey Keller, Tim Howard in goal. You know, you flip a coin, you put whichever one you want there. Yeah. You had myself, Eddie Pope, Tarundolo, Eddie Lewis, DeMarcus Beasley, Leonard Donovan, Claudio Reyna, Clint Dempsey, Bobby Convey, yeah, Pablo Mascheroni, Brian McBride. You had players that could get it done. Eddie Johnson at that time, and he was, yep, super hot at that time, right? And we had a lot of ability, and I would say that we underachieved in that World Cup. Definitely the opener, we got slaughtered. By Czech Republic, they just murdered us. We regrouped the second game against Italy. We should have won. They took a goal away from us that shouldn't have been. And right there, you could say that might have changed the trajectory of the tournament and how far we went. And then in the last game against Ghana, we were robbed because, yeah, if you look, yeah, back at it in the penalty,
minute 46,
I don't know what minute it was, but they called a penalty. There was no contact. You replay it. You can go slow-mo if you want. There is absolutely zero contact. And I'm looking at the referee like, what? And the guy on the ground's like, I'm sorry.
He said, I'm sorry to you.
Like, I'm sorry. There, you know, if there was VAR at that point, I think it would have been reversed, but you know.
So people who are watching us, this is the play where the ball gets thrown into the box and pretty much you beat the player to it, and there's very minimal contact, but you're the bigger man, and he goes down.
What happened
was called.
The ball, it was on the left side, and Carlos was trying to clear it, but essentially cleared it back in the middle of the box of the field. Mm-hmm. And the guy, I forgot who it was, striker, he was like, he came up to my chest, and I kind of just poked my head and headed away, and this guy just falls. And my hands are actually up like this at the time. So I was like, there's no foul. My hand was like this, and I head the ball away. And all of it here is the whistle. And I'm like, what's he whistling? Maybe he's whistling offsides. I don't know. He points at the penalty spot, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me. And that was it, you know. And we were really – I think we had a good chance of advancing had we had won And we had a good chance of winning, to be fair, because we were all over them. We were excited. We knew that this was our last chance, and we gave it everything we had. But, you know, the referees were not having it that day.
Was it a bittersweet feeling for you? Because obviously you get to play in a World Cup, but it doesn't go the way you guys had hoped for with such high expectations that were on this national team. I mean, 2002 was a resounding success. The qualification process, the FIFA ranking, what were the emotions going through you and that you saw around the team?
I was pissed off. I was pissed off. I was pissed off for myself. I was pissed off for some of the veterans because I knew this was their last shot. In Brian McBride, in Eddie Pope, in Casey Keller. I really thought that they deserved more out of that tournament. And, you know, like I said, it was sweet because, you know, obviously not everyone gets to play in a World Cup. So you get to play on that stage, but it was extremely bitter because you know you underachieved, and that you could have done a lot more. But there's a number of factors that go into winning and to success, but you know, not all of them were on our side that tournament.
So between Belgium and now that World Cup, you started making a name for yourself. You actually go to AC Milan, one of the most storied soccer clubs in the world. And I'm going to read off some names just so people know how stacked that team was. Andrea Pirlo, Ronaldinho, Dida, Seedorf, David Beckham, Huntelaar, Pato, Gennaro Gattuso, Alessandro Nesta, Kevin Prince-Boateng, Robinho, and Zlatan, to name a few. What was your first experience just stepping on to that field, to that locker room? What was that like?
To be honest, like in my head, I built it up, right? So you're like, oh shoot, you've arrived, right? Now you have to see what this kind of locker room is like, what this kind of environment is like. And I was very, very pleasantly surprised to know and to see that the locker room was very, just much like every other locker room, like jokers and cool cats and all that stuff. So I was welcomed, you know, cause everybody's just a down to earth person, or most everybody, was a down to earth person. So I felt good there, you know, and made a lot of friends and had a lot of good relationships.
Well, first off, if Belgium was a lot of attention for you and you were the best players in Belgium, what's it like now when you're a Milan player in Italy? What's that attention like?
Yeah, it's, you know, to be fair, I've been fortunate with some of the clubs I've been on, in regards to the country. So like when you're in Belgium and you're playing for either Anderlecht or Liège, like everyone knows you wherever you go and you're known. when I went to Milan, it was no different. When you play for Inter or Milan or Juventus, or, you know, if you play for one of those top three, like everyone knows you, and especially within the city, everyone knows you. And it's good. It feels good. You know, you get certain accesses that you probably normally wouldn't. And it's a great city. And then it's an even better club. It's a very family oriented club. And you don't think about that when you hear the name AC Milan, but when you're within it, it's they protect you, right? All you have to worry about is football.
Hey, let's talk about that team for a second. I mean, anytime you play on a great team, there are always these questions asked about what was it like, you know, these players. For you, day in, day out, you got to see these players train. You got to see their habits. You got to see how good and bad they were. Who's the most talented on that team?
Ronaldinho. Ronaldinho, people will argue, and probably right, his time in Milan probably wasn't his peak. You know, his peak was probably at Barcelona.
Yes.
But you still saw it, right? And you could still see it, like the stuff that he does with ease while he's laughing or just joking around. It would take the average player probably 2 months every day to practice it, you know? And I think that in regards to talent, he's probably the most talented.
Obviously, he's been in the news for his recent legal troubles, the falsification of documents, international documents, and he was actually jailed for a period of time in Paraguay. What's going through your head when you see this news?
what's going through my head is that the same thing could have happened to me with fake IDs in Clemson University, trying to get into bars and whatnot. But no, it's unfortunate, and you know, hopefully he sees the light at the end of it, and you know, he's a great person. I don't think he's met a person in this world that will say any, you know, otherwise about him, and this will just be a blip on his storyline, you know, because I don't think it's going to taint who he is or what he's done in the world of football.
He's so loved by everybody. I had the opportunity to play against him in Liga MX, and it's funny because it's well documented. After every game that he played with Querétaro, he would charter a private plane. Didn't matter where, if he played home or away. He played against us one time at Puebla, and we beat Querétaro 4-0. That day from Puebla, chartered a plane to Cancun. And after every game, he'd go to Cancun and he'd party. And he'd come out in all the tabloids in Mexico, because Mexico football is a big deal. And he didn't care. He would do this without fail. It's very well documented. I also heard in Milan, it was very well documented about his off-the-field endeavors. And I heard he'd had parties that would last 3 days.
I can't confirm nor deny those allegations. I can't, you know, but I will say that during in Milan, he got a bad rep, and that the partying that everyone said he did wasn't to the extent that everyone said he did it, right? Everybody liked to go out. Everyone had a good time, myself included. So I think that whenever anybody saw him going out, it was multiplied by 50. Like, oh, he's out, you know, and it could be like half the team's right next to him, but they're like focusing on him, right? And like I said, like, he's a good guy. And, you know, I think he's one of the only – there's a few of them that he can play at any stadium and the away team are going to applaud him. You know what I mean? Regardless where he's playing at, you know, whether it be Madrid, whether it be Barcelona, any team, stadium, home or away, they're going to applaud him. And that's a rare feat for any player around the world.
Absolutely. Talk to me about the culture of that team, because I look at some of these names like Gennaro Gattuso, and obviously hard-nosed players, and obviously Italy's known for being more of a serious defensive grit type of league, at least back then. What was the culture like during the training sessions?
Italian culture is very tactical, you know, and for a lot of offensive-minded and flair kind of players, it might get boring. For a defender, it's very educational. A lot of information based in regards to positioning, tactics. If this person moves, how do you move? And it's a lot of the coach talking and a little bit of you playing. And that's just the Italian style, you know, and everyone says, oh, Italy is tactical. Spain is more technical and individual, but, it was definitely, that's the Italian. That's why they, you know, they won the 2006 World Cup. You know, they were strong as a unit. You couldn't break them down unless you were Team USA, who did, but we're not going to go back there. the Italian mentality, the Italian culture is based around, tactical soundness.
You know, Hector Moreno, who's a Mexican national team player, when I interviewed him, he actually said, this is a comment that it's known now. When he was in Rome, he said, I didn't know how to defend until I got to Italy. When I get here, I realized I didn't know anything about defending, and I still had a lot to learn.
It's true. There's a lot of things, and especially as an American, right, that I wasn't taught. And I know a lot of the – there was one coach – from the academy side. And he said, I remember he said to me one day, he goes, you could have been the best defender in the world had you had been born in Italy.
Wow.
And he was like, you have so much of these raw talents, your strength, your ability, your mentality. He's like, but if you had been born in Italy, you would have been one of the best players in the world.
Is that what we're lacking in the United States? Was that what USSF is lacking at the coaching, the knowledge?
I mean, yeah, knowledge, but that comes with culture, and culture comes with time, right? You can't build a culture overnight. It's an ingrained atmosphere. It's an ingrained ideology. It's an ethos. And until that is formed and developed and nurtured and groomed, you know, where do we stand? It's just about the different ideas bouncing off the wall.
You say we can't build a culture overnight, and I'm 100% with you. But you and I are the same age group, and because of that, you know what Project 2010 is. You know that there was this famed U.S. project where the U.S. is going to win a World Cup by 2010. We were both at that World Cup. It didn't go that way. So this is obviously things that you've tried planning for. What's gone wrong?
I mean, aspirations are always good to have, but the reality is there's a multitude of factors that will hinder you from achieving that aspiration, whether, you know, because we say Project 2010, who's to say that 40 other countries don't have a Project 2010, you know, and they're doing everything and maybe more to achieve that, you know? So I would say that a lot of things in this country need to improve. Well, they do need to improve, but a lot of things need to get aligned. A lot of people need to get on the same page. I think within our youth structure and our professional structure as well, there needs to be a lot more collaboration and a lot less competitiveness in competition, right? And I feel like there's so many positives and intangibles that this country has in regards to its sports culture. And if we could, as heads and educated individuals within the sport, you know, use each and every one of them to promote ourselves instead of tearing each individual down and saying, mine's the hierarchy, I should do this way.
Right.
Instead of saying, you know, mine is good for this player, this might be good for that player, and at some point it's going to funnel to the top, which is the national team. And like I said, not exclude avenues like the college system into the pyramid. You know, if you look at who is it, Jordan Morris, right?
Yeah.
College player, right?
Yeah.
Everybody loves the kid, but nobody speaks about him not going to college. No one speaks about the fact that he went to college, right?
Right.
There's a number of players. If you look at our old roster, you know, Eddie Pope, mm-hmm. Ryan McBride,
yeah,
myself. I mean, there's the names go on that.
But is it too complicated, Gooch? Because when you look at other countries and there's a clear path of how to make it, it's more of a straight line. And then you look at our pyramid and you have, well, you don't have DAs anymore, but it's DAs. It was, you know, Alianza Football because these kids are outside of this, you know, net that's being cast by USSF. You have MLS reserve teams, academies. You have club soccer. You have the college game. Is it all too muddled? Shouldn't it just be, I guess, for lack of a better term, easier?
I would say that the pathway seems a lot more linear in other countries. I will say that I know individuals that have made it that did not take the traditional pathway, so it's not always linear. But I think that our issue in America, one of our issues rather, is that we try to look at every other country and do it that way, right? To say that we can, you know, unless America was the size of Texas, mm-hmm. we can't do that. We can't put together the same plan that Belgium puts together, who is smaller than Florida, right? Or Germany, yeah. Or whatever. I think there need, like I said, that's where the collaboration needs to be, whether we divide the country into six parts. I mean, I remember growing up in the ODP program. I won't say that was the best, structure. But you know, it allotted us a lot of opportunity to play overseas, to kind of compete and understand that if you didn't make that team, you weren't of the upper echelon. And there was this kind of grit and pride within making a state team or making a regional team, as you know. And so I would say it has to come from the higher ups to understand that we're unique in the sense of our size. We're unique in the sense of how this country is structured, because if you look at the different regions, there's different tendencies, right? West Coast kids don't play like East Coast kids, don't play like Midwest kids, don't play like Southern kids. You know, it's like a number of different countries all in the USA. And we have to be able to understand that, embrace it, and then grow that. Because that kind of diversity within our country is what our strength is. You know what I'm saying? And people are seeing that as, oh, that's hindering us. You know, we have to conform everybody to one style and one way. I'm like, that's our strength. we're a freaking melting pot of a country. You know, we're over here, you know, Mexican American, I'm Nigerian American. We're all American, right? And this is how you embrace it. This is how you grow it. And this is how it makes it better.
Now, staying on this Milan thing, I've had the opportunity to interview Zlatan, and this was just recently, less than a year ago. And I asked him, because in his book, he documents this scuffle that you guys had at training. I asked him what happened, and he said that, you know, one challenge from him, you kind of reacted, and then he says, before you know it, we went at each other, and he says, he came at me. And he describes you as a heavyweight boxer, championship boxer coming at him. And then he describes the moments. I believe he said he headbutted you, and then it was a scuffle, and you guys are on the ground, and then everybody comes on top. He said he suffered broken ribs. What do you remember about that training session?
Well, I remember everything. I remember everything about that training session. And just to note, you know, he's had a great career. Great player, yes. Phenomenal player. I think he made his mark in the MLS in the short time that he was here.
Yes, he did.
You know, both on and off the field. but I would say in regards to that altercation, I'll call it, I see no purpose in rehashing it or giving the details. I will say that in his book or his accounts, there are some truths. There are some lies.
What is the lie?
Exactly. That's what everybody wants to know. There are some truths. There are some lies. That's all.
All right. Let me just ask you. Is it true that you broke his ribs?
Ask him. It's his ribs.
He said he did. He said his ribs were broken. I want to know just from you, because I know you. You're not a dirty player.
I'm not a dirty player. I'm not a dirty person. So, you know, if I had to go to that length of being now storied because of that, then there was something else that occurred. But whether I broke his ribs or not, if he contests to it and says it, I'm not going to comment on it.
He says that if they don't break it up, if the team doesn't break this up, one of you guys is going to die.
Did he say who?
He's a big guy. Gooch.
He is. He's a big boy.
And he's an expert in martial arts. Is there a part of you, and also that he's slacked on, is there a part of you that when you're going into this, you're a young guy trying to make a name for yourself in a different country and one of the best teams in the world, and all of a sudden this altercation happens? Does that all of a sudden fly out the window and now you're just thinking about what is transpiring, or is this crossing your mind?
Well, at this point, I'm not a young guy anymore. I'm like 28, 29 years old, and I think we're the same age, or he might be a year older than me. So
he's about a year or two older. I think he's going to turn 39 in October.
Yeah, he's a year older than us. So at that point, age and names didn't have anything to do with anything at that point. You're a man, I'm a man, and this is what it is.
Now, after this incident, you leave Milan, and you end up going to, I believe, this is qualification out for the World Cup. This was right after the Charlie Davies incident. You guys play in D.C., I believe, against Costa Rica. And what was it? Johnny Bornstein scores a goal that sends the U.S. to the World Cup. Is that it?
No, we had already qualified before that game.
Correct. I'm sorry. He scored the goal that sent somebody else to the World Cup. I think Honduras?
Honduras to the World Cup.
That's what it was. Correct.
Kicked Costa Rica out of it.
That's exactly what it was. But you get injured this game.
Yeah, I did. It sucked, man. And, you know, the story of that last 72 hours was crazy. You know, we were in deep. I forgot where we had played prior. Maybe El Salvador or Honduras.
I think in Honduras.
And leading up to that, Charlie had gone out, as everybody knows. And the next day, I woke up for an appearance, and Michael Cameraman, who was our press guy, he comes up to me and he says, you know, I know you're very close to Charlie. I have to tell you before anyone knows that he got into a serious car accident. And I was, you know, I don't even know how to explain, but I was kind of shocked. There was no feeling yet. And then I was like, oh, you hear accident. I'm like, all right, well, he's fine. And I was like, is he okay? And then he said, I don't know. And he's like, I was like, is he going to live? He's like, I don't know.
Wow.
And so then it hits you. And I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, what happened? What's going on? And then the next day we have this game against Costa Rica. and we're playing in DC, and we had already qualified, and nobody knows this, but obviously I had planned to see my friends and family and go out with the team and celebrate just the World Cup, and going after the game. And I dreamt the night before the game that I wasn't able to go out with my friends and family. Something happened that prevented me from going out, and I was pissed because that's all I wanted to do was see my friends and family. And I had woken up and I was like, oh, that's weird, whatever. And played in the game, and a corner kick comes. Normal corner kick. I jump up to kill the ball, and somebody kicks me in the back of my hamstring. So I'm on the ground in the box looking for the referee, like, that's a penalty. I know I got kicked. And everyone's looking at me. The ref's looking at me. I'm like, all right, when are you going to blow the whistle? And next thing I know, I see Costa Rican players, like, rush, like waving over the trainers. And I'm like, what's wrong with these guys? And then I look at my knee, and it's in my quad. Mm. And I'm like, ah. I'm like, damn it. Nothing goes through my head. Trainer comes over. Ivan comes over. First words, literally, how long? And Ivan's like, don't worry about it. I said, Ivan, how long? He said, don't worry about it. Don't worry. We don't know. I said, Ivan, how long? And, you know, you could tell he didn't want to say anything. And in my head, the immediate calculations of the months, what day we were, when the next national team before the World Cup came, all these time periods and time frames and calculations started going through my head. And fortunate enough for me, I was obviously able to make it there, but it was crazy.
I was part of that 2010 World Cup team, and I still remember everywhere we went, you would carry a game ready with you. And for those who don't know what a game ready is, it's an ice machine that has compression as well. And I know very well what it is because I've had knee injuries. You use that on your knee to kind of rehab, and you carried that thing everywhere you went. How long did it take from the moment you were injured to get to back to 100%? And where did you feel during that World Cup?
During that World Cup, I was probably like 80 to 85%. Maybe probably 90 on any given day. But then the most difficult one was the recovery after the game and if my knee would react, et cetera. And that was what I was trying to manage, was how it would react between the games. Was I able to play the consecutive games without skipping? But the first game that we played against England, no issues, no problem. And it was after that game and the intensity and the impact that, you know, I was like, oh, okay, the recovery, okay. I might need more than 2 days to recover for this. But you know, it's all said and done. But like you said, the game ready was my best friend for probably, 9 months after recovery, you know, because if anybody knows any kind of serious injury, it takes time for your body just to get acclimated to its
absolutely
the foreign things within it and just settle.
All right, Gooch, we're going to jump around a lot and we're going to go through a lot of different players, teams from your past. Let's see, you go to Malaga in La Liga in Spain, and I believe it was Manuel Pellegrini who was the coach there.
Mm-hmm.
First question is, such a complex system that he operates where it's high press, recover, you know, the opponent's half. What was it like playing for a coach of that caliber?
It was different. Pellegrini, playing in Spain was different. I remember, you know, obviously coming from Belgium, France, even Italy and Portugal and even Holland. I remember the first couple weeks he was like, you have to learn not to use your hands. And I was like, what? He's like, you can't touch people in Spain. And I was like, what do you mean? It's football. It's contact.
Right.
And like intentionally in training, if I would like touch a player, he'd call a foul. And I'm like, what the hell are you doing? I was like, what are you? He's like, foul. I'm like, foul where? What are you talking about? And you'd have these little Spanish players that just flop and fly. And I would get so frustrated because I was like, if I really foul you, you're going to be in the hospital. I'm sick of this. And, that was probably the biggest learning curve in that country. It was just, you know, obviously to understand that that we were playing basketball. There was no contact, right? But yeah, his tactics were a little different defensively, especially coming from Italy. I remember one was all four defenders cannot drop back into the 18-yard box until the ball crosses that line of the 18-yard box. And I was like, this goes against everything I was ever taught.
Right, you're facing your own goal now.
Right. I was like, what about the distance of support? And he's like, nobody goes in. I was like, okay. And then I remember players like DeMichelis, he was like, "This is, you just have to do it. You have to listen to it and just do it." And I was like, I don't know if I can just not do that. And it was different. But the team itself was, it was great. It was a great team. Great. You know, Malaga is like a vacation city. The sun's always shining. It's on the beach. It's right there in Andalusia in Spain, right in the south, right, you know, a couple hours from Sevilla. And, it was a good time.
Now, I believe at this time they had a Champions League, just European ban, I should say, not just Champions League. They couldn't play any European matches, but you guys still had some very good players. I think Isco was one of the younger players at that time.
Oh, it was 2021. We didn't get the European ban until afterwards. We actually went to the quarterfinals in the Champions League, lost to Dortmund in the quarters. So, Isco was there. Tulalan was there. Batista was there.
Julio Batista, yeah.
Roque Santa Cruz was there. Saviola was there.
Nel Conejito, yeah.
Yeah, Joaquim.
Was Isco amongst the best players there already at that young age?
Isco was the best player on the team. And I think he was like 19 years. He was playing on the Spanish under 21s at the time. And I remember when I transferred to the team, it was during one of those transfer window international break periods in August. And we were at training, and me and Tulalan would speak a lot because French, whatever. And he came up to me and he was like, he's like, the best player is not here yet. And I was like, who's the best player? He's like, Isco. And I was like, oh, where is he? He's like, oh, he's with the national team. So I didn't know who Isco was at the time. And I'm thinking national team, like first national team, like Spanish full team. He comes back and I'm like, this kid? I was like, wasn't he just on the under 21s? And he was like, just wait. You'll see. I see this kid play. It was like I was watching early 2000 and one basketball mixtape. This kid was on another level. He was snaking people. He was doing all these things. And I was like, okay, now I understand what he was talking about. You know, he was special. He was special.
Let's look back down memory lane. I asked you yesterday, what's your greatest game? You told me your greatest game was the U.S. men's national team versus Spain in that Confederations Cup game where you guys beat – the best team in the world, 35-game unbeaten streak. To show you how good this Spanish team was, they had won the 2008 Euros, the 2010 World Cup, the 2012 Euros. They were completely stacked. I'm going to go through really quickly and give you their lineup. Casillas in goal, Puyol, Capdevila, Sergio Ramos, Gerard Piqué, Xavi Alonso, Cesc Fabregas, Reyes, Fernando Torres, and David Villa. They had a stacked team. To put things in context, this is your back line. It's Carlos Bocanegra on the left, Ewan J. Demerit in the center, and Jonathan Spector on the right. Now, I want to know first why this was your greatest game.
Well, I had a lot of great games, you know, and I have a lot of...
of course you did.
I have a lot of great memories, you know, played a lot of great teams and great opponents and great teammates, but this specific game stood out just because of what it meant and what was on the line. So this was the semifinals of a FIFA tournament, right? And at that point, we were the underdogs. I don't even think we thought we were going to win because we were like, you know, if we lose against Spain, that's not so bad. I mean, everybody loses against Spain, you know?
Exactly.
And we came out with that. I remember the night before, or maybe a couple of days before the game, I forgot who it was. One of the coaching staff said he's going to jump in the cold pool in our hotel if we beat Spain. And everyone's like, okay, he's never going to do it. So we get into this game and it was like everybody on our team was in the Matrix, right? It was like Super Saiyan, Goku, everybody, you know, and, you know, we get that first goal and we get that second goal. Charlie and Josie are just killing their back line. And for whatever reason, like you said, they can't penetrate our defense. And I don't understand why. I was pulling clearances out my hat. Carlos was doing stuff. Spectre was playing like he was Cafu. You know, it was one of those things that you can't explain, but all the stars aligned, right? And they were so frustrated because they kept on coming and kept on coming, but they couldn't get through. And it was such a monumental game for us. One, because we beat basically like one of the invincible teams.
The world power, yeah.
Yeah, we beat a great team. Two, because we made it, we were the first men's U.S. national team to ever make it to a FIFA final, you know, and three, you know, we beat Spain 2-0. I can always say that. You know, great.
I want you to try explaining it to me tactically. What was the message from Bob Bradley? Because you know Bob very well, and Bob's and his crew, Jesse Marsh and Sorber, the night before, they're handing you the week before USB sticks. They're sticking into laptops. You're studying players. Obviously, there's some tactical approach to this game. What was it?
I mean, obviously, Bob's a very tactical person. He's very not defensive minded, but he wants to be strong defensively. Mm-hmm. And he told us that, you know, basically stay compact, let no space go in between the lines. If we can beat them on the fast counterattack with Josie and Charlie, then that's what we're going to do. And we're going to exploit that. And that's essentially what we did. And we almost won the tournament doing that against Brazil.
Yeah.
So we were really strong. We knew that, you know, we're not going to take any risks. Obviously, this is not a game to be dribbling out the back or to try to meg people here and there. It was a tough game. It was a tough game. And for 90 plus minutes, we had to give 200% of ourselves for the team. And that's exactly what everyone did.
Fernando Torres, David Villa, anything you remember specifically about that game defending those two players?
I remember red flashes. Just going across my, I tell you, man, it was, I remember David Villa and I spoke to him afterwards a couple times, in the States. And I was like, you remember that game? He was like, and I was like, come on. He's like, man, he's like, you guys were incredible. He's like, we couldn't get past you guys. We tried everything. And I was like, I don't know either, you know, but it was incredible.
Yeah, you've already said how many different countries you played for. You've been privileged enough to play in some of the best leagues in the world, the Premier League, La Liga, Serie A. Out of all these leagues, for you, what's the best league in the world?
Best for what? Best for me or best in general?
In general.
I've never played in this league, but I would say that probably Germany is probably the most complete league that I'm seeing, you know, because I think if you look at England, it's the most exciting league to watch, right? Because it's just so fast paced. It's like goes from one end to the other in 4 seconds.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times, you know, and now England is a lot less long ball, and a lot more structured and tactical, but it's very quick nonetheless. And you look at Spain and you have the technical ability and the, like, you know, how did this person control that ball and how do you make that pass? And, you know, you have these tacticians essentially. And you look at Italy and then you have all this tactical prowess and like every team doesn't want to get broken down and games are 0-0, 1-1, 1-0, you know. And then you see Germany and you see all of that, you know, you see these almost robots, machines that are just like built to withstand everything. You got tactical players and teams. You have technical players and teams. The game is fast. They're strong. They're quick. They're everything. And I've never played in Germany. So this is my outsider's perspective of it. I would say that league encompasses the best parts of all of them.
Now, having experienced these different countries, these different leagues, is there anything a piece of advice you would give Major League Soccer, what they could do better?
Oh, man. Get me with this. Major League Soccer, what they can do better. I mean, I think at some point the salary cap issue is going to have to be looked at and revised in regards to, you know, a player on the team making $6 million and another player making $50,000. It just – the discrepancy is not there. Whether you scrap the whole – salary cap or you amend it in some ways to promote a more competitive league. That's one issue that I know everyone's talking about. Obviously, the promotion relegation everyone wants to talk about, and whether or not we're structured or we're able to right now versus down the line. I think that might be a conversation for a little further in the future.
Do you think it can exist pro rel in the United States and Canada?
I think it, I mean, like I said, if it did, it would have to be structured differently. Cause how many teams now do we have that are entering the league now? Like 31,
30.
Imagine a promotion relegation with 30 teams, right? That's a lot of teams.
Right.
To play.
But does it have to be, I guess my question is, because you've experienced so many different types of cultures, does Major League Soccer have to be the driving force of pro rel, or should it be the federation? Because you, obviously you have USL, you have NASL that has their own issues with that. You have other, I guess, entities involved. Does Major League Soccer have to be the prime force or the driving factor?
Well, right now it is, just because of the status and the conditions that we've been seeing and going through. I think U.S. soccer is going through a restructuring of its organization. And so in essence, right now, Major League Soccer has no alternative but to be, you know, the driving force of whatever happens, whether U.S. soccer comes back and takes control of everything. That's neither here nor there, but essentially, in most countries, it's the federation that takes control. Maybe not initially, because I know, like, probably in the English FA, the federation takes control of it, but early days, it wasn't the case, right? It was the leagues that were controlling it and kind of manipulating things until the FA got strong enough and structured enough to be able to withstand that and take that responsibility.
All right, a few more questions, Gooch. Let's see. You've played for a lot of U.S. men's national coaches. You played for Bruce Arena, Bob Bradley, Jurgen Klinsmann. Which one of these coaches had the best player pool at his disposal?
Golly. The best, I'd say Bruce, because we were ranked number two or three, right? No, I mean, they were great player pools for all of them. I think Jurgen definitely opened the floodgates for foreign-born American citizens, and mm-hmm. so which kind of threw a curveball into the whole player pool in essence. So I think the player pool, while under Jurgen, was a lot broader.
Mm-hmm.
But even though it was broader, it still wasn't as encompassing as it could have been or should have been. I think the Latin influence in the team is still lacking, which is crazy because of the strong Latin influence that we have in this country, right? But on the men's team level, the players just aren't there yet, for whatever reason.
When you look at the current player pool, which is Greg Berhalter's player pool, how would you assess it?
Very promising. I would say that because of the progression and the growth of the modern player, I think individually, all these players are potentially better than all the other individual players from previous years.
Mm-hmm.
I would say what they're lacking is the collective ability that former national teams had.
Identity.
Yeah, they don't have that identity. They don't have that cohesiveness as a team. But if you take each individual player, you'd be like, oh, wow, this player is playing here. This player is playing here. They're like, they're there. They have the ability. They have the technical ability. So now how do you take individuals and make it a unit? And so that's going to be their main challenge.
You've played in 8 different countries. You've got 2 World Cups. You've got a Confederations Cup final, one of the best defenders to wear the jersey. What happened in 2018, in your opinion, that failed World Cup campaign?
Oh, man. Besides losing to Trinidad.
Yeah. Is it just that game? Are we reading too much into it?
I mean, no, 100%.
Right.
No. I think it happened years before that. And you could break it down if you want, because if you take that Trinidad game and you replay it 10 times, the U.S. might lose 1 out of the 10 times.
Right.
Maybe 2. Maybe on the lucky day. Because if you replay that game, we're going to beat them. So I think that the question is, why did we leave it until that game, the last game, to be able to qualify, which we had never done before, right? I think there were elements of that leading up to it. I think in 2015 or 16, I forget which one it was, we lost in the Gold Cup. I think we lost to Jamaica. We lost in El Salvador. In El Salvador, there were all these little hints of breakdowns, but then people have goldfish memory and forget about it once a victory happens. And they're like, oh yeah, we're great. We're on track after a victory happens. And then they don't understand that it's systematic, that we were underachieving at almost every level in our pyramid. Like our youth national teams weren't qualifying either.
Right.
The 20s,
the Olympic teams.
The Olympic teams didn't qualify. And then it was only a matter of time that worked its way up to the men's team. And unfortunately it did. And I would have bet that we would have qualified at that game, you know. And then, you know, you look back at it and you look at the little chips on the wall, you know, you're like trying to create a hole and you're just chipping away year by year. And then that one game was what broke through the entire wall. But I think it was building, and I don't think it was a product of that one game. Right. And
correct.
If anybody says that, they're foolish because they don't know what football is, or they haven't been paying attention to the games or the structure in previous years. But what that did is it was a good slap in the face. It was a good wake up call, a hard wake up call, like in cold water thrown on you to get ready for school. And right now it's the responsibility of the current players, the current pool, the current coaching staff, the federation, to rectify the 2018 issues and work towards that never happening again.
Talking about the federation, what can the federation do better? Is it a sense of them maybe changing what they do, or changing personnel?
I think they've been changing personnel for a little bit. I think that's two presidents in the matter of what, 4 years, 3 years, something like that. It's a lot, and I know that they've been getting a lot of stick and a lot of negative commentary here and there, and I just think that internally they need to review things, right? And whether it be a personnel change, whether it be a structural change, whether it be a tactical change, but there has to be some kind of reform in some way, shape, or form from the first team all the way down to the youth system. You know, there has to be something in place that makes people want to get excited about, right, and get behind.
Absolutely. Gooch, man, I've had a lot of fun with you. I've taken up a lot of your time. I really appreciate this, my man.
No, I appreciate it, man. It's not every day you get interviewed by, you know, by Aquaman, and you know, I'm really
looking Khal Drogo.
Yeah, seriously, this has been great, man. This has been unbelievable, and I wait for another 10 years before you call me to interview.
If you're ever out in LA, once things get back to normal, you know you got a place out here, my man.
Amen. Thank you, brother.